I'm Wendy. I serve the village as education associate. And I have to say that I have mixed feelings about declaring this as your final session. I wish you would be here. I could listen to your storytelling and history for hours and hours. But yeah, tonight is our last night with Roy. We're really been blessed with your teaching and your humor and your heart for all of this. And it is a recorded session, so everybody knows. I think you all know that. But thank you, Roy, for making this final session happen and for being flexible.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, it's been a delight being here. Thanks again to everybody, the staff, the directors, the pastors, everybody that's here at Holden, not only for what you do, but for inviting us in. I've really enjoyed the other sessions with Matt and Elizabeth and others that have been presenting, and it's been a real treat. And it's a real treat for me, and to see so many of you here, I know that you're all gluttons for punishment. I really am appreciative of your being here at this hour after a long, hot day, and to hear a little bit about C.S. Lewis. If you've been here through all three, and even if you haven't, just an overview, we've been kind of looking at this medieval idea of the Mysterium Tremendum, the idea of the terrible mystery of God, and the idea of mysticism. And I just want to suggest, we've been looking at Friedrich von Hugel's kind of typology, suggesting that any valid religious tradition has three elements to it: tradition and ritual, which we're introduced into the faith with. Secondly, the idea that when we get a little bit older, we're given these teachings and these doctrines and these ideas, and then when we get older as adults, we start having experiences that kind of call into question simple answers, easy ways of thinking about what faith is. And so the experience and wonder of mystery and mystery of God then ask a great question at the last session, wondering about what is the difference between mysticism and, you know, just going out and smoking something, right? And I think the big difference I mentioned at that point was that mystery is something that always surprises you. But I also think it's something more than that. I think it's something that puts you, it gives a sense of meaning and purpose to life. And I use Dorothy Zala as an example, her book, The Silent Cry, suggesting that we need to be amazed in the world. And when we're amazed, we have to let go of something, usually. And then that, in order to live in mystery and wonder, we have to really resist the world. And so last time I went and talked a little bit about Celtic spirituality, kind of some resources that they offer to us, different ways of thinking about mysticism. And today I'd like to follow up with talking a little bit about C.S. Lewis. My background with Lewis is that I was asked by Lutheran University Press to write a biography about Lewis, and so I started reading everything I could about him, started teaching classes, and I've been doing that for a number of years. And I was really struck by the person that I found, who was very different than that person that I thought he was. And especially Lewis is very popular amongst evangelical fundamentalists, conservative type Christians, and they see his apology work, his books on miracles, and a variety of other texts, The Problem of Pain, and those that really come out of his early work as kind of central. And I was really struck by kind of the mystical side of Lewis. And I was especially struck by his understanding of nature. So I'd like to go through that today. I want to do a reading. I think this is the best text I can find on Lewis where he talks about nature and creation. It's from his Four Loves, his book, The Four Loves. And I'm going to start with this and then kind of go through his life and kind of talk about some of the ideas that he has with regard to mysticism. Lewis writes, "For some people, what we call the love of nature is a permanent and serious commitment. I mean here that love of nature, which cannot be adequately classified as just simply a love of beauty, is something that takes us away from ourselves. For example, there are many natural objects like trees, flowers, and animals that are beautiful. But the nature lover, whom I have in mind, is not simply concerned about beauty of that sort. A true nature lover is one whose mood or spirit wants to receive as wholly as possible whatever nature has to give to that person. That is, so to speak, an obvious richness, an understanding of grace and harmony that seems to be a part of our world despite all evidence to the contrary. And these things are precious. But I also want to say that nature has a grimness, a bleakness, a terror, and a visionary dreariness at times. These things, when they are laid bare to the sheer quality of a countryside, if you give yourself over just to an hour, if you want to simply be absorbed into nature, simply for an hour, it could color you for a lifetime. If you take nature as a teacher, she will teach you exactly the lessons that you have already decided that you wanted to learn. This is only another way of saying that nature, in essence, doesn't necessarily teach. The tendency to take her as a teacher is obviously very easily grafted from our experience, from our love of nature. But really what we should gather from nature is a sense of overwhelming gaiety, insupportable grandeur, somber desolation that are often flung at us through a walk in the country. Make what you can of all these things, if you must make anything at all. But it is imperative that whenever you go into nature, it simply says this: look, listen, and attend, and set yourself aside. Many people, and I consider myself one of them, says Lewis, would never, but for what nature does to us, have had any content to be put into words. We must use when we confess our faith. Nature never taught me, this is an interesting line, nature never taught me that God exists, or that the God of glory and infinite majesty exists. What nature taught me was the meaning of the word glory and the meaning of the word majesty. And I still do not know where else I could have found those sense of meanings. I do not see how I could have understood the word fear when I connected it to the fear of God had it not been for nature or anything else. If I had never seen certain ominous ravines and unreproachable crags, and if nature had never awakened a longing within me, huge areas of what I now consider the love of God would not be a part of my existence. Say your prayers in a garden early in the morning. Ignore the dew on your feet, the birds and the flowers, and you will come away overwhelmed by the freshness and simple joy of life. Go there in order to be overwhelmed. And after a certain age, you will understand what I mean. C.S. Lewis was on the cover of Time magazine in 1947. It was an interesting time in his life. He had been writing a lot. He had come out as an apologist, or one of the foremost spokesmen for Christianity in the 1940s. He became very popular during World War II with the radio series that he did, which later became a book called Mere Christianity. And so as a result, his editors, is there something wrong?
No.
Oh, okay.
As
a result, his editors asked him to write an autobiography, which he refused to do. He says, "I have the most boring life. I am an Oxford don. I go and teach during the day, and I go home. And I go to my dog, and I clean up his poops. And that's, you know, all I do." So he didn't want to write this. But he had converted to Christianity from atheism, and they thought that that was an interesting idea, that they wanted a story about his conversion. Lewis eventually agreed to write an autobiography, but of course, in typical manner, he didn't write the biography that anybody wanted him to. He wrote a book called Surprised by Joy, The Shape of My Early Life. It really goes down to 1955. Lewis would die in 1963 on the same day that John F. Kennedy was shot,
wow,
and the same day that Aldous Huxley died. And so Lewis, in his book Surprised by Joy, writes this in the introduction. "I do not want you to read my book unless you think that there is something about the concept of joy that might be interesting to you. How far my story matters to anyone but myself depends to the degree on how much others have experienced what I call joy." So Lewis's quest for joy is really what he's trying to explain here. And if you attend closely to his themes and ideas that go throughout, and you know anything about his life, it's a pretty surprising, and this is, I have to admit, one of the most shocking things that I discovered as I was reading Lewis. Lewis writes, "In order to pursue the question of joy, I would like to take you back to my childhood, which is the most interesting part of anybody's story. After that, I will go very quickly, and I will skip some very important matters which I do not intend to share." And there are some scandal about Lewis's life. He jumps over those things. But he starts out very early, and always, right away in the opening pages, he makes this observation. So here's the little boy Lewis in his nursery, his little toy in the corner. And he says, "The transformative experience of my life was when I was just a child, when my brother Warney," which is short for Warren, "brought into the nursery a little toy garden. It was a lid, it had a lid, it was a biscuit tin with a lid, which he had covered with moss and garnished with twigs and flowers so as to make it this toy forest, a toy garden. That was the first beauty I ever knew." He goes on to say, "A few years later, I was walking by a flowering currant bush one summer day, and suddenly, without warning, as if from the depths of not years but from centuries, the memory of that earlier morning at that old house when my brother had brought his toy garden into the nursery came flooding back to me." Now, Lewis was born in 1898, and he was living in Belfast. And so he's in Ireland at this time. And he says, "It is difficult for me to find strong enough words for the sensation of the memory of seeing the toy garden, which came over me. I think Milton, John Milton's phrase, 'the enormous bliss of Eden,' is the closest I can come to it. It was a sensation of desire. But a desire for what? Not certainly for the biscuit tin. That's not all that impressive. But what was it? Before I knew what I desired, the desire itself was gone, and I found myself longing for the longing." So Lewis would go on and then say right after this in his text that he was really taken not only by this experience of this biscuit tin, this toy garden, which he said later, any vision of paradise he had would have an element of that biscuit tin toy in it. He said he also would look out his window, and he wrote, "I looked out, I thought of the toy garden, and I would look at the green hills or the Castlereagh hills outside my window, and they taught me one thing, Sehnsucht." And Matt mentioned this word with regard to Bach the other day, that Bach also was very interested in Sehnsucht. So, what is Sehnsucht? Well, he says, let me read the full phrase. I had a longing called Sehnsucht, and I became a votary of the blue flower. Now, those are very strange things. What does that mean? Sehnsucht and a votary of the blue flower. Well, there's a man by the name of Matthew Arnold who died in 1888, and he said, Sehnsucht is simply that woeful longing that is within all of us. And Lewis wants to identify joy with this idea of an agonizing wanting. It's not happiness. Happiness is happiness, right? It makes us feel good. But longing is an ache. It's like something's missing in your life. And at the heart of this for Lewis was joy. So a definition that I kind of come up for Zane is that it's an idea, you get this from Lewis, it's an idea that you hope for some sort of ideal, When Lewis saw the toy garden, when he sees the Castle Rail Hills, what is he really longing for? It's something that they're pointing him to, some sort of ideal. And that gave him a sense that his own life is incomplete, that there's something missing in his life. And he's so deeply lost in the moment. Remember that thing he says, I felt this desire for the desire, and then when I was realizing I was desiring the desire, it was gone. And as soon as you start thinking about joy, it isn't there anymore. I started analyzing it. So a bittersweet longing, it's this deep bittersweet longing that we have. A longing that helps us put life in its proper perspective and that gives symbolic richness to everything that we see in life. Some people are writing, so I'll leave that there for a sec. So what does all this mean? Lewis says right after this, he says, what the toy garden and what the Castle Rail Hills taught me is that, quote, I had a longing for a place that I had never been to, that I knew was home. Well, what does that mean? A longing for a place that comes up not out of the sense of years, but out of a great sense of centuries. It's like it's bigger than himself. Well, he also said that he was a votary of the blue flower. And what does that mean? Well, Lewis is clearly borrowing on the romantic authors of the late 19th century, and especially Georg Philipp Friedrich, who used the alias of Novalis, and he was writing this novel in which he talks about being a votary of the blue flower. And what the book really is trying to get at is that within our human existence, and Lewis is getting some of this from Samuel Coleridge, who wrote The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. The idea is that we have an imagination within ourselves. This is a faculty of our human self. Our ability to take realities, a horse and a horn, and put them together and have a unicorn, which doesn't exist, but nevertheless has great power and meaning for us. And our imaginations can help us understand the universe. And it is in our imaginations that our imaginations make some sort of creative leap from the toy garden to this place that we would call home that we have never been to, that we long for this place. Now, Lewis is doing this in retrospect. He doesn't think about this as a kid. He gets this later, but I have to set this up. It's kind of like Don Quixote, right? Don Quixote, that windmill is a giant. And I need to overcome it in order to make the world a better place. Or I'm going to reach for the unreachable star, right? There's something about this longing in us to make the world a better place if we go back to that sort of definition we had. So now let me set up Lewis's biography, which we'll take a detour, and then we'll come back to this idea of longing and Sehnsucht. So Lewis is young. His father is a lawyer. Fairly preoccupied with his job. His mother, Flora, is a mathematician. She's very brilliant. She's teaching Lewis at an early age languages. He's incredibly bright, picking them up rather easily. And when Lewis is 9, he has a toothache one day, and he comes down to his mother's bedroom to be comforted, to get some sort of medicine, hopefully that he can go to sleep. And he is shooed away from his mother's bedroom, because her cancer has now moved into a critical stage. She's moving to the point where she's going to die. And Lewis talks about how he longed to be comforted but was sent away because his mother was dying. And his mother would die at the age of 9. And he writes of this event saying this, when her case was pronounced hopeless, I remember that I had been taught, that prayers offered in faith would be granted, and so I prayed, but she died. The thing hadn't worked. It was a fraud. With my mother's death, all settled happiness, all that was tranquil and reliable, disappeared from my life. It was all sea and islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis. Lewis's father, Albert, had rather significant tragedy himself right at this point in his life. Lewis's grandfather was living with him in the house, and when Flora became ill, the father, Albert, sent the grandfather away to another place because he couldn't take care of both of them. The event of moving him out of the house killed him. It was too traumatic. So Louis Albert lost his father, and then in another unusual accident, his brother died, and then a few weeks later, his wife died. And so Albert is completely crushed, and he doesn't know what to do with these two boys, a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old. And he decides to send them off to Hogwarts in England, a boarding school that was awful. He got into Slytherin. You know, it was one of the worst places he could have been sent to. But 2 weeks after his mother dies, he's sent away. And Lewis is crushed by this. And in fact, the guy, the schoolmaster where he was at, was later found certifiably insane and locked up. So this gives you an idea. Lewis's chapter, the name of the chapter in the book is called Concentration Camp. That's school. You know? And this was after World War II, so nobody was talking about. And so he has this incredible deep sadness in him, and he doesn't quite know what to do. Every sort of you can see Flora up on the top, and there's Albert and his brother Warning. And he was called Clive Staples Lewis, but when he was five, he announced to his parents that he wanted to be called Jaxie. He would not answer to anything except Jack or Jaxie, which some people think was the family's dog name, but they're not sure about that for sure. But anyway, Lewis was sent off with his brother Warning to school. He was utterly devastated. He says that he had no sense of joy or happiness. And while he's in this awful place, in this awful school, Lewis starts to read books. And this is where imagination comes back. And one of the books he stumbles on, of all things you might wonder about, is this Tale of Squirrel Nutkin by Beatrix Potter. And this is his description of that book. He said, "The book uttered an absolute shock to me, and I was deeply troubled. What troubled me is I cannot really say. The only thing I can liken it to is it's like the book gave me the idea of autumn. It sounds fantastic to say that one can be enamored of a season, but that's something like what happened. As before, the experience was one of intense desire. I longed to escape into the books with my imagination because they seemed to point to the same place that the toy garden and the Castlereagh Hills had pointed to. I wanted to reawaken something from my youth which had died in me. To my surprise, it was difficult, but I began to find it in books." Not only does he find it in books, but when he gets a little bit older, he starts reading poetry. And this will become one of his great long life loves, his poetry. He loved Longfellow. And he read this poem, Tegner's Drapa, which is basically about Norse mythology. And one of the great characters in Norse mythology is a character named Balder, and he's in the middle. You see the guy with the arrow is just about to kill him. The story of Balder, he's like the sun god in Norse mythology. And Lewis says, "I knew nothing about Balder, but instantly when I read Longfellow's poem, and I heard the voice crying out, 'Balder the beautiful is dead, I was lifted into huge regions of northern sky. I desired with almost a sickening intensity something never to be described. I found myself already falling out of that desire and wishing I were back in it.'" So suddenly he finds, if we just think about it for a minute, you know, when he's young, nature moves him to long for this place that will make the world right. He knows something's wrong with the world. But he has this longing and this desire for it. And it's kindled not only in nature, but also in his imagination, in books that also had nature in them. For Lewis, the character of imagination was something like this. If I go into the story, if I read the story of the Lord of the Rings, right? How many people are familiar with the Lord of the Rings? Most of you? Okay. So if you've seen the movie. Let's say I imagine Samwise at the crack of Doom, Mount Doom, right? Samwise is there with Frodo, and Frodo can't go on. He's just crushed, right, by this whole thing. And Sam picks him up and says, "Mr. Frodo, I can't take the ring, but I can carry you." And he takes him up the hill. When I saw that in the movie, I was just weeping. Right? You know? And the thing Lewis would say, well, why was I weeping? Because In my imagination, I am living courage through Sam. And that courage is as real as any courage I might experience in my life. In fact, not only is that real, it might be more real because I may never have that opportunity in my life. And Lewis says in his imagination, he began to kindle this joy again. It started coming back to him. It was as if he was peeking through a door at something beyond. Oh, you can't see it very well. That's Dorothy looking out at the Wizard of Oz. That scene is, remember, this is all black and white in here, and she's walking out through it. And I want to read a quote from Lewis at this point. Lewis says, "I doubt that when anyone has tasted this thing that I call joy or desire or longing or a bittersweet longing for this land, I doubt that if it were in their power, they would exchange the whole world for just one moment of that joy." That joy, unfortunately, is never within our power. It only comes when we can barely cling to it. So, how does this work for Lewis? So let's go something like this. Lewis says, you know, when I'm thirsty, I go and get a drink. And when I'm tired, I go and sleep. When I feel like I need to get out of the cold, I go into a house of shelter. We have these longings and desires within us. And then he says, but what about that longing and desire to be in that land that we've never been to that's home? Where does that come from? And he thinks it's in the same place and the desires and the longing that we have for every other desire and longing that we can fulfill. But there's something unique about this one, right? It seems just beyond our touch. It's just beyond our grasp. Well, so Lewis then starts studying and reading ferociously in the original languages. He's fluent in Greek, Latin, French, German. He has a reading knowledge of Italian. And he's 16. And he's an incredibly brilliant kid. He's doing really well in these awful schools, but he's having this. So he's just kind of retreating into libraries, and he's getting lost in Greek mythology. He loves Celtic mythology. That's a building. You can see that, if those of you following me along, you know. He loves Celtic mythology, especially the ideas of nature. And by the way, in the Chronicles of Narnia, he borrows the idea of talking animals completely from Celtic mythology, and a lot of those ideas are from there. He loves Norse mythology perhaps more than anything else. And he finds that the idea of thin places that we were talking about and thick time can not only be found in nature, but they can also be found in books. They can also be found in the imagination. They can be found in play. They can be found in especially the arts for Lewis. He started and discovered Wagner at this time and the Ring Cycle, and he started immersing himself in music and other sorts of elements of the art. But at this time, remember, I said when he was a kid, he said, "I prayed that to God to heal my mother, and that never happened." Lewis clearly is not a Christian at this time. He writes to his good friend Arthur Greaves, whom he had met as a young kid, the only other kid in his neighborhood that lived in Ireland when he went home for breaks. They were the only ones that read Norse mythology, and they would get together and read it. He writes to him early on. He says, "Dear Arthur, I believe in no religion whatsoever. Christianity is just a made-up myth invented by people according to their own physical and emotional needs." Sounds like Freud. He's actually reading Freud at an early age, and he's picking up on that. He says, "What is Christianity and God? It's nothing but lies breathed through silver." So he clearly has very little interest in Christianity as a religion, although he finds truth in Greek mythology, Celtic mythology, and all the other mythologies that he's reading. That's going to be a problem for him. He won't be able to reconcile that in a moment. He's terribly upset with living in these awful schools, and he finally convinces his father, "Dad, you've got to get me out of Slytherin. So his dad says, "Okay, I'm going to give you a teacher." Happened to be his father's teacher. The guy would die just a few years later after Lewis would be done learning from him. His name was William T. Kirkpatrick. He's a character in Lewis's stories, The Narnia Chronicles, Diggory Kirk, which is clearly from a play on the word Kirkpatrick. And Lewis would call him the Great Knock. And the Great Knock was a fierce atheist. And he taught Lewis all sorts of, he taught Lewis not to be slothful in thinking. So the first time he meets the Great Knock meets him at the railroad station, and they're walking back to his house, where he's going to be the only student that the Great Knock has. And the Great Knock's walking back, and he's not saying anything, and Lewis looks around and says, well, this is kind of a wild countryside around here. And the Knock stops and says, what do you mean, wild? And Lewis goes, he says, explain yourself, young man. Lewis doesn't know what to do. He says, look out there, tell me what looks wild. And it's very beautifully groomed fields, with rock, the sort of English countryside. Lewis goes, he says, well, if you don't have anything to say, don't talk. But if you're going to say something, describe it accurately. Now, that is his first encounter with the Great Knock. He would love the Great Knock. He would spend lots of time with him. He would teach him how to reason carefully and understanding. And as an atheist, Lewis just took to the Great Knock very much. So interesting that he's a central character in a number of his stories. If you've read The Pilgrim's Regress, the Great Knock is a woman character in that story, Mrs. Kirk. So in any case, Lewis is still hanging on to this idea of longing. And it is the central element of his life, even as an atheist. And Bertrand Russell at this time makes a very interesting comment in some of his writings, and Lewis would know Russell's writings. And this is Russell writing to one of his friends in a letter. He says, you have asked me what motivates me and drives me as a human being. The center of me is always and eternally that terrible, painful longing at the center of my life. It is a searching for something that is beyond this world, that contains something infinite. It is what I call the beautiful vision. It is not God. But I know that it is a longing that I have to make the world a better place. I do not seem to find it in this world. Maybe it cannot be found, but it is the love of my life, and it is the spring well from which I operate. Well, Lewis loved this same idea. As an atheist, he clung to this idea of longing. Now, Lewis one day jumps on to a train. He's now teaching at Oxford. He's going between London and Oxford. And he happens to grab a paperback book called Fantasties by George MacDonald, a 19th century writer who wrote fantasy, one of the great early fantasy writers. And this particular edition has an introduction by C.S. Lewis. And Lewis started reading this fantasy novel, and he writes this. He says, I grabbed the book and jumped on the train, and I could not put it down. A few hours later, I had read the entire thing. And not only that, but I had crossed a great frontier. The story baptized my imagination. It took me back to Elfland, to the land of fairy, to the place I hoped to go or longed to be in, but could not find. Another great tragedy that would happen in Lewis's life would be World War I. He was ready to start at Oxford, but he was sent off as a soldier. That's him on the left, and his friend Paddy Moore is on the right. And Lewis's friend Paddy Moore would be killed almost immediately. Most of his friends would die in World War I. And Lewis would be injured very early on, and he would wind up being in a hospital for most of the war. And while he was there, he started reading. And he kept coming back to these myths and fantasies. He started reading more of George MacDonald. He stumbles upon some literature by G.K. Chesterton, and he starts finding this quite interesting. Well, he eventually will go home, and as many of you know, there was a great literature outpouring after World War I by poets. Wilfred Owen, right? Benjamin Britten's great War Requiem uses Owen's poems and other poems by other soldiers that had been in the war, and Lewis decided he would try his hand at it as well. And he wrote a book called Spirits in Bondage, and it became one of his first books that he published, and he published it under the name of Clive Hamilton. Hamilton was his mother's maiden name, and Clyde was his real first name, even though he went by Jack, so nobody would know who he was. But notice, I just pulled out a few lines. Notice that the idea of longing is still here. Come, let us curse our master ere we die, for our hopes in endless ruin lie. The good is dead, let us curse God on high. And now notice, so he's talking about how God has created this sort of senseless world that allows wars like this. How could, you can't believe in a God like that. It doesn't make any sense. And then towards the end of the poem, he writes this. Open the gates for me. Open the gates of peaceful of the peaceful castle, rosy in the west. If you're Arthurian crowd, part of Arthurian interests, this Isle of Apples, the Isle of Avalon, the word Avalon means apples. He's referring to Arthurian literature here. Open me that castle of rosy in the west, in the sweet dim Isle of Apples, over the wide sea's breast. Open the gates for me. When I find thee, O country of dreams, beyond the tides of oceans, hidden and sunken away, out of the sound of battles, near to the end of day, full of dim woods and streams. And he goes on, I will have found my longing. So his longing is still there. And this is central to Lewis's idea throughout his life. So let me just briefly sum up what we've done so far, and then draw some points that I think will help us get to the next section. He says, first of all, he finds beauty in nature and physical objects, toy garden, green hills, in his imagination, in books, especially poetry, myth, and now fairy stories, or fantasy literature, what would be known as fantasy literature. But Lewis comes into conflict between two things. One, reason. A cruel world cannot allow for God. And the idea that Christianity is a myth, something that's made up. And yet, in his imagination, he knows that he has a longing for a land of dreams. So, where does this go? First of all, just let me tell you a little bit about his conversion to Christianity, and then we'll move right to the final point about what joy is all about. So Lewis goes on and becomes a professor at Oxford. He starts teaching there. One of his closest colleagues, a guy by the name of J.R.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson. Tolkien was a wonderful man, very kind and gentle, and a Roman Catholic. And Lewis distrusted him from the beginning. He thought Tolkien was way too religious. But they had similar interests in a new field called English literature that was just developing at the time. And so they were developing this program at Oxford. And one night, Hugo Dyson, Tolkien, and Lewis are walking around. They walk till about 4 o'clock in the morning outside, and they're talking. And Tolkien just asks Lewis this one question. He says, Lewis, tell me what you think about myth. And he says, in Greek myth and Roman myth and Celtic myth, there is truth. The truth of human experience. When you read, he says, Hippolytus, and you long for the land of the gods, right? Or in Norse mythology, when you long for the, that is truth. And then Tolkien says, well, what do you think of Christianity? It's a myth. Well, he said, isn't that a contradiction? And Lewis started wondering. Well, Tolkien says, even if you take Christianity just as a myth, and as if, this Jesus fellow didn't walk around, isn't there truth in that? Or isn't there something overlapping? Lewis says, I was like a fox flushed from the woods. He didn't know what to make of it. He starts to wonder, personally, if there might be something more to Christianity than he really thought. He talks about this as a grand chess game. It's hard to read, but he says, first of all, he has this longing for the land that he's never been to. Secondly, his experience and his reason gets him into a corner where he suddenly realizes that he's so mad at Christianity that he realizes there's a contradiction in his thinking. He's mad at God for killing his mother, but he doesn't believe in God. So for him, the contradiction started raising these sorts of questions. He began to think about the idea to suggest that it seems like our reality is as if we are in a dream. And when we wake up, we will come to this truth of this place that we are all longing for. But what about God? How does this work? So for Lewis, it's something like this. He realized when I was a kid, I'll use myself as an example. When I was a kid, I used to go behind my house in Odessa. There was a pond and there was little frogs. And, you know, they would grow up from tadpoles. And I would go down, bend down, and I would put them in jars, and I'd watch them grow and get legs and things and let them go. And I knew everything about frogs. I loved frogs. I experienced frogs. I was muddy with frogs. My parents, my mother, who was very neat, didn't like this at all. But especially when I brought them home, and they might get out and run around the house. But in any case, later on when I got older, I found out that I was in high school that we were going to learn more about frogs. And that was back in the day when you still had to chloroform the frog, the live frog. Remember that? Some people did this. And then you would cut the frog open. It was horrifying, you know.
It would kill the brain, but it would still be alive, so you could see the heart pump.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's even worse. It's horrifying. When I saw E.T., I was so glad the kid lets the frogs out. You know? That's my childhood. Lewis says that's kind of the way we live. He says we have this sort of experience in which we experience frogs or we experience life, and that's really real. But once we step back from it and we start thinking about it and analyzing it, we have to kill the experience. And that's what we do in religion. That we have this mystical understanding of God and the world and our place in it, but once we move to tradition and teachings, too often we don't allow the mystery its place, but we use it to dissect what we think. And in the process, we kill the thing that we love. And therefore, we sometimes lose our attention to religious convictions. That's how he understood himself moving away from Christianity. He says when he came to this sort of realization, he said, "The discovery flashed on me like a light illuminating my entire life. I saw that all my waiting and watching for joy was all, and hoping that I could contain it and control it, all my vain hopes to find some mental content in which I could somehow speak and understand it and say, this is it, was all futile. The only thing I knew how to do from that point on was to let go and allow joy to happen, and not to overanalyze it. Awe overtook me." I could try to explain to you what my family means to me. This is a picture of us in Ireland. The first time my daughter and wife really enjoyed Guinness. We just climbed a hill, my boys and I had enjoyed it before. But I could try to explain to you that. But if I start explaining to you it, I would start dissecting this. Just to let you the picture, have you allow you the picture of what this is, what this means to me, is a better representation of what my family relationship is than me trying to tell it to you, because I would have to dissect it. You see what I'm getting at? And you see where Lewis was at? Okay, so I hope that gives, that's a cheap example, but let me get to the end. So here's how it all comes about. I'm at the end of the book now, and it's off. This picture reminded me of Holden, so that's part of the reason I put it in here. So Lewis says, gets to the end of the book, and he says, so now he's at a conflict. He says, it's more important to me, says Lewis, that heaven exists than God exists. God doesn't necessarily have to exist for me, but the longing that I have for heaven is important. It's that Sehnsucht, it's that desire that's within me. So he says, how does this work? He says, let's imagine that I'm in a dark wood wandering. Anybody know what the opening line of that book is? Dante's Inferno, right? He says, it's like I'm in a dark wood wandering, and I'm lost, and I don't know where I'm going, and I'm desperate for food and hunger and shelter, and I need to get out of this forest. So I'm wandering, and I think I'm at the point of death. And let's say I imagine suddenly that I see a sign in that forest. Now, if I see a sign, and that sign is pointing, say, home, or to a place beyond this world, I would find great joy in that sign, wouldn't I? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But wouldn't I be the greatest fool, says Lewis, if I went over and grabbed the sign and hugged it and thought, this is my joy. I'm going to stay here. Well, Lewis says, that would be utterly foolish. Every one of us would say that is idiotic. Mm-hmm. suddenly Lewis wants to distinguish between two things, joy, small j, and joy, big J. Small j joy is any happiness that we have in life. And every time you're happy, when you're walking out on the trails, or you're visiting with somebody here, or you're having a beer with your family, or whatever makes you happy, that is like a sign in the forest, pointing you to something beyond itself. That's that longing that we all have within ourselves, says Lewis. So what we should do is enjoy it, but not make it our end. It is a means, but not an end. So let me give you another example with Guinness. Let's say Peggy and I have a fight. I'm right, she's wrong, obviously, and we have this big argument, and I tell her that she's wrong, and she's kind and patient as she normally is, so she tells me to go sleep on the couch. So I go sleep on the couch. Now, I'm not happy, and I want to be happy, so I like Guinness, I go to the refrigerator, and I think one Guinness should help with that happiness factor. A six-pack will probably really do me well. So I start drinking because I want to be happy, right? Beers make me happy. And next morning, my wife comes down, and she sees six cans of Guinness laying around the floor, and she's not happy, and things are worse than they were before, and it goes on and on. Now, Lewis would say, even the beer cans of me drinking in that moment are like little signs pointing to true happiness, but if I try to use them to be my happiness, right, they're destructive. What I need to do is I need to do the best that I can to get home or make my home, and that would be to admit I'm wrong, I'm sorry here, I love you, and then you know we could make up and we could start moving along. But even the happiness I have with her is pointing to something else, right? Don't we all deep down have a longing? Sometimes when I talk with college students about fantasy, the reason they love fantasy is because they want to be in that world. You read that book, you want to be there because there's something about that world that helps you think about how this world might be a better place. It's this deep longing in Lewis. So Lewis, in the end of his book, says this. He says, I stop and I stare at the signpost, and at first it makes me very happy. I realize that I'm no longer lost. I should not linger too long. I should move from one joy to the next, keeping the destination in mind. I would be home in Jerusalem. However, that doesn't stop me from getting sidetracked by little shiny rocks. That's the end of his book, Surprised by Joy. One of the things that Lewis does quite well in all of his literature is that he realizes that his great task as an artist is to use the imagination to help people connect with their longing. And here he writes, when I speak, this is from a sermon called The Weight of Glory towards the end of his life. He says, when I speak about a desire for our far-off country, which we find ourselves, even now, I feel a bit uncertain and shy talking about, I am trying to somehow rip open a secret that is lying within all of us. The secret is that we cannot hide and cannot tell it at the same time, though we all desire it. We cannot tell it because it is a desire for something that we have never actually, has never actually appeared in our experience. We cannot hide it because it is our experience and is constantly suggesting that there's something farther beyond. And we betray ourselves like lovers at the mention of our lover's name. Our commonest expedient is sometimes we call this thing beauty, but it is more than that. The books or the music in which we find beauty located betray us if we trust them alone, if we cling to them like a sign in the forest. It is not in them. It only comes through them. And what came through them is longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, and we become silly worshipers. For they are not the thing itself, they are only the scent of the flower that we have not yet found, the echo of the tune that we have not yet heard, the news of our far-off country which we have not yet visited. It was when I was happiest that I long the most. The sweetest thing in all my life is longing to reach the mountain, to find the place where all beauty comes from, my country, the place where I ought to have been born. The place where I ought to have been born. Do you think it meant nothing, all that longing all your life, the longing for home? For indeed, it now feels as though it is not like going, but rather it is returning to the home to where we have never been to. So Lewis starts writing Narnia. He starts writing these children's books to create longing, and the same thing with his friend Tolkien. And they become, because of this sense of mystery, because of the sense of longing, Tolkien and Lewis became some of the strongest advocates of, during England at this time, there was big deforestation projects and industrialization going on, and they were trying to stop the forests from being cut down. They were one of the earliest advocates of ecological rights in England, and nobody really knows about this story at all. And if you look, and one of the ways they decided to try to subvert the industrialists of this day was to make trees characters in their stories that, like Ents, right, were creatures worthy of preserving. Using the imagination to turn the society against itself. Lewis was one of the most outspoken advocates against, I mean, he fought this. There was all sorts of experimentation with animals back in those days, you know, using them for these things. Lewis hated this. He thought this was terrible. And so the Narnia Chronicles, in part, was a way to subvert what was going on in his own society. We know very little about this side of them, but they became strong advocates and, for nature and creation and the wilderness. The other thing that Lewis and Tolkien were always concerned about was their desire to communicate these ideas well through stories. And Lewis wrote science fiction because Tolkien said, I don't think you can write a science fiction story, so he wrote a trilogy. Lewis said to Tolkien, I says, you should write a time travel novel, which Tolkien started, but he got lost in The Hobbit and never got back to it. But if you notice the 1960s, these books were incredibly popular. And they resonated with the hippie communities and communities that were going out and living in the wilderness, and that sort of ecological movement that started in the 1960s, the Earth Day movement and that. Tolkien and Lewis, I think, had a huge impact upon them with their works, although I don't think it's ever been credited or well documented. But in the end, what Lewis simply wanted was this idea of longing. And he tried to understand that he believed that the longing that is placed within us is here to help us not only make the world a better place, but also help help us make our lives, and what I mean by us, community of collections, a better place. And that longing is something that I think we all have, that bittersweet longing that's within us. And that's why I think, I mean, they created, literally created the fantasy genre in the West, and thank God they did. So let me stop there for a minute. I've thrown a lot at you, and I've taken a lot of shortcuts because it's hot. And do you have any questions or thoughts or observations about what I've said? Yeah.
You mentioned something about thin places in thick time. We talked about it before, but I wasn't here, so I was wondering if you would just could briefly explain.
Yeah, in Celtic spirituality, and Lewis was very immersed in Celtic spirituality, there was this idea that there were places in the world where the veil between this world and the next, the other world. Mm-hmm. For the Celts, that was with the gods, the Danann. For Lewis, that would be like heaven or some place like that. That there are places that are very thin, and I think Holden is a good example of that. The reason we come to Holden is because we feel closer to something that's really important. I think that longing in here is something that we feel more intensely here at Holden than we may feel at home. We kind of fall asleep at home in our routines. And that's why we come here, because we want the world to be a better place. And Holden does that on many levels. It does it liturgically, it does it through programming, it does it through just working outside, it's all that sort of stuff. When you have a thin place and you encounter it, and you feel the sense of awe and longing for something better, time seems to slow down. That's what thick time is. You know, that you seem to live in the eternal present, and you have these memories of, you know, that moment when something spectacular happened. Does anyone remember standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon for the first time? You know, it's just like, it's like you're outside of yourself. For Lewis, this is the key point. I knew there was one point you saw me struggling at the end, I skipped right over it. For Lewis, the idea of joy is this, that you lose yourself completely in it. That the other, you don't do it for, I don't love my kids because I'll get something out of it. Right? If my kid comes to me and says, "Dad, you know, I really love you, but I'm not going to do that unless you give me a car." Is that real love? You know, it's not that. You love because you don't care about yourself. The more you lose yourself in the other and get lost in that longing or whatever it may be, that's what's really key for Lewis. That's what joy is. And he realizes at the end of it, he says, "All my life is searching for joy, and when I realized I couldn't think my way to it, I was dissecting the frog, or I couldn't get it any other way, I just decided I had to give up the quest and just let it happen. I just had to go on the journey into the forest and trust that it would be there." And for him, it was. It's that. But it was always about a place, not so much about God. And that's, I find, really interesting. He thinks that desire for the place is within us all.
He talked about finding truth in the other mythologies, like North mythology and Norse mythology and Greek and stuff like that. I'm curious, what were the idea of Christ figures throughout different mythologies, and I'm curious, like, what were some that he experienced that helped him understand the role of Christ in his own conversion?
Yeah, he thought...
And what were their role in those respective mythologies of the Christ figures?
Lewis is very unusual in this, that he sees truth in other religious traditions, especially Greek and Roman ancient traditions, which most people just saw as false. He thought that the human story was one great story, and that the reason we are drawn to resurrection myths or stories is because that is all of our human story, that there's something inside of us kind of seems to rail against death and says, this isn't natural. And so it comes through in everything. For him, it comes from all these stories. So Apollo, Balder, and all these other sorts of myths, they have these great resurrection elements in them, and he saw that that was his truth. And that's really unusual, I think, because in that day and age, those people really, religion was seen as kind of a rigid, we're right, you're wrong sort of thing. And Lewis kind of could see it everywhere. If you read his book, The Great Divorce, it's fascinating, because in the end, you know, he kind of goes into this Dante purgatorial place. And really, I think he's suggesting in that there's this idea of universal salvation. That as long as people eventually, people are in their own selfish worlds, and Napoleon lives 2 million miles away from everybody else because he keeps going, walking around the room saying things like, it was Josephine's fault, it was, you know, something like that. But Lewis thinks that God's love is kind of an irrepressible thing. By the way, George MacDonald, who is the writer of Fantastes, becomes his guide in Purgatorio Place, and George MacDonald was a universalist. And I think, so Lewis could see those truths and other things. He does ultimately say he thinks for himself that Christianity is the true myth, because Jesus was a real human being for him, you know, and that's how he sees it. But he certainly opens the door and speaks favorably about other religious traditions. I want to say one other thing about Arthur that nobody really knows about Lewis. Lewis does speak out against homosexuality as an example. You know, in the 1950s, of course, he would see that. But his friend Arthur was homosexual. And he was his dearest friend to his dying day. His last letter, one of his last letters, is to his friend Arthur. And it's one of the most beautiful, heart-wrenching letters I've ever read. The last line is, "Oh, Arthur, to never see you again." Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, in an intellectual worldview of 1950s Christianity, he speaks out against homosexuality. He thinks it's a choice, you know. But in his actions towards Arthur was very, very different. And I find it very complicated because of that, as is with his world.
What was his wife's name?
Joy Davidman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are a good movie, Shadowlands. There's a lot of inaccuracies in it, but it gets at the spirit of who Joy was. Joy was a Jewish atheist communist, just type of person. And she was married to somebody else, and he was abusive to her, and she fled to England. She had started reading Lewis's books, met him, they fell in love, and had a very strange relationship, but eventually came to love each other very deeply, and she died very shortly after. After that, she got cancer.
Interesting that Joy is part of.
There's a great new biography that's out about her that just came out, and I recommend it.
What was the thick time?
Thick time is when you're in a moment where you feel that sense of longing or that Sehnsucht, and time seems to slow down. And we were talking, who were we talking about? Somebody, Linda. Is Linda here?
Yeah,
Linda, we were talking about time, and you were saying, say what you were saying about time.
Oh, I went to a cabin because I was exhausted. I was sort of mad at God and felt like the weekend wouldn't revive me to do what I wanted to do. I was living with you. And so I told God, all I'm doing is I am going to just listen to my body, and I'll eat when I'm hungry and sleep when I'm tired and drink when I'm thirsty and walk when I need to walk. And within 24 hours, I was totally revived. And I realized it was a different way of being present. And
you said that felt like you'd been doing that for like a week or a month.
Yeah.
So that's when you're present to yourself, time slows down. In fact, these sorts of meaningful memories are things that you can recall. And that's why Lewis calls it longing for longing. It's part of that memory. You have this memory of that great longing and for things to being right. You know, I've had students in my office sometimes talk about, you know, families that are breaking up and getting divorces and things, and they say, the first thing they seem to go to is kind of like, I remember when I was a kid and everything seemed right. I wish I could just go back to that. You know, it's sort of a longing for what that real family would be, but it's not there anymore. And so you know the world isn't quite what it should be. Yeah.
So it sounds like he equated joy, capital J, with this deep longing that sounds almost painful.
It's agonizing, yeah.
So how do Christian communities reconcile his definition of joy with this? I feel like what I've perceived of joy is a deeper sense of happiness.
Yeah, and see, Lewis doesn't want to go there. He doesn't want to talk about happiness. He doesn't want it just to be about what makes me happy, because he thinks that's kind of a cheat. And that's what I think happens in Christianity. I'll speak about my own tradition, but I think it happens in all religions, is that we find shortcuts to happiness, and we think that's it, and it's only going to be this. And Lewis felt that the deepest, and remember that one quote, he says, if we have it just for a moment, we wouldn't trade the world for it. We know that there's something really important in our lives, in our longing, and that the world can be a better place. I think Holden, for me, is a lot like that. I come here and I get that sense again. You know, if I try to keep it in my life, but I don't think this is something talked about much. You know, I read this book in my introduction to religion class now because I have a lot more students that are atheists and can relate to kind of that sense of longing, even though they don't understand, they don't want to connect it to a God. But at least I find a common language that we can kind of work together towards. I think that longing can move us and motivate us to make the world a better place, to help us find our way in a world where we struggle. And Lewis and Tolkien did it so quietly. You've never heard about the things that they do, and yet it was really important to them. Lewis gave away almost all of his money to charity. He had very little when he died. And he gave it away to children's. He funded orphanages and things because he made money off children's literature. He thought it was important to give the money back. Mm-hmm. And he hated Disney, and they made Narnia. He thought they always made the endings too easy. Well, thank you very much. I've had a delightful time. And